This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Enormity in concept of what the Mishkan really was. It's not just a matter of making a tabernacle, a sort of a portable Beis HaMikdash with various specifications. It's not just that it's a feat of engineering, but the concept of creating a Mikdash, of creating a place of sanctity, the concept of creating a place about which the Ribbono Shel Olam says, "V'shochanti b'seichom," I will come down and my presence will dwell there to bring the Ribbono Shel Olam down to this world. The Mishkan, as we said, mentioned even last night, that everything in the Mishkan was a physical manifestation of the most exalted concepts and spiritual powers that exist in the worlds above, which in turn are the spiritual sources of everything that exists in the material world, which means that the Mishkan was a microcosm of the entire universe. It was a model in which every concept, every major principle, every major object in the universe was manifested and expressed in a physical form. And through that, the Ribbono Shel Olam was able to come and so to say, to place his Shekhinah there, and that could all be made by man. This is something unbelievable, and Moshe Rabbeinu finds difficulty, as we see in the opening Midrashim of the Sedra. Moshe Rabbeinu finds a difficulty in conceiving of the possibility of the human being able to create an Beis HaMikdash. Moshe Rabbeinu finds that so intriguing, that the human being is capable of creating something of such kedusha that it represents the Ribbono Shel Olam's own chambers, so to say. That's where the Ribbono Shel Olam chooses to place his presence. And this idea is expressed in various different midrashim, one of them which reads as follows: Vayichu li truma b'shor sh'omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe. When the Ribbono Shel Olam said to Moshe, Aliske HaMishkan, concerning the matters of the Mishkan, Omar Lefonov, Moshe Rabbeinu said to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ribbono Shel Olam, Yecholim em Yisrael la'asoisoi, are Yisrael able to do such a thing? Is it possible that Yisrael can make such a thing? How can they? Do you realize what it is that you're asking? To create a Beis HaMikdash? To create nuclear power stations, that they can do. To create rockets that can go to Mars, that they can do. To create computers and microprocessors, that they can do. But to create a Mishkan, something which is going to bring the Ribbono Shel Olam right into their midst, to create something which is an expression of the ultimate of Kedusha, where are they going to have the knowledge, where are they going to have the purity, where are they going to have the resources, the energy, the physical material that they're going to need for it? How is it all going to be done? It seemed like a task which was totally beyond imagination. And here Moshe was charged with instructing the Bnei Israel, you jolly will go and build a Mishkan. Something quite beyond imagination. Amar LeHaKadosh Baruch Hu, so the Ribbono Shel Olam answered him in the following way. Afilu echod miYisrael yochel la'asos. You don't understand the power of the Jewish people, Moshe Rabbeinu. You think for the whole nation of Jews, 1 million of them, 2 million of them, 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 50, You're worried about whether they have the capabilities of producing a Mishkan, of constructing a Mishkan. I want to tell you, Moshe Rabbeinu, any Jew could do it on his own. You don't even need 600,000. One member of Bnei Yisrael could build a Mishkan all on his own. That is the power of the Jewish people. Shneimar, as it says, Me'ez kol ish asher yidvenu libo. It doesn't say Me'ez kol asher yidvenu libo, that you should take the donations from all who feel generous. It says from every man who feels generous. So the word ish is an extra word that doesn't need to be there, and the Medrash learns from the inclusion of the word ish that it comes to connotate even a single man. An ish, one man, is capable of doing everything that needs to be done and of creating the Beis HaMikdash. Amru Rabbonon, the Medrash goes on to say that Rabbonon said, Af b'mon shehoyo yored liYisrael, hoyo yoredes b'yavonim tovis u'margolius. Even with the mon which came down for Yisrael, they came down together with it also precious stones and pearls. V'hoyu hagadolim shobohen boyin u'melaktin oisom, And the Gedolei Yisrael came and collected those precious stones, Bahayu Goinzin Oisom, and they hid them away. Teido Shekein Hu, one can see that it is so, Shenehemar, as it says, Vahem Heviyu Eilov Oid Nadova Baboike Baboike. And they brought gifts to the Beis HaMikdash every single morning. Asked the Medrash, V'chi Baboike Hayu Meviyin, B'tzorayim Lo Hayu Meviyin, did they used to bring only in the morning? At midday or in the afternoon, you weren't allowed to bring donations? What's so special about the morning? So it comes to teach us, Mimashe Hayo Haman Moirid Lohem Heviyu. They used to bring in the morning from that which the Mon brought them. It indicates to us that the gifts that they brought had been collected from the Mon, which used to come every morning. V'chein hu omer, and that's also what it means, v'hanesiim heviu, which normally is translated, and the princes brought, but the Medrash takes nesiim to mean not only the princes brought, but nesiim also mean the clouds. And the clouds brought these precious stones and all sorts of things to the Bnei Yisrael, and the Gedolei Yisrael collected them and put them away until they were needed for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. There's two parts of the Medrash. The first part, an expression of amazement on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam that the Jewish people are capable of building a Mishkan. The Ribbono Shel Olam's answer that not only are the Jewish people capable of building the Mishkan, but even one Jew is capable of building the Mishkan. And secondly, the Medrash's statement that precious stones were collected by the Gedolei Yisrael at the time of the Mon. What does the Medrash mean? The capability of the Jew to construct the Mishkan. And what really is involved in that capability? What does there need to be? There needs to be Kedusha, there needs to be Chochmah, there needs to be understanding. And the condition which the Torah lays down, and the very posuk from which we learn that any Jew has that capacity. In other words, this posuk teaches us of the infinite ability of the human being. That's it. We're looking at a very special posuk. That posuk that teaches us that the human being, that the Jew, is capable, the individual Jew, never mind all the Jews together, the individual Jew, is capable not only of understanding and creating the most magnificent technological constructions, but the individual Jew is even capable of creating the Mishkan, which is a model of the entire Olam, both upper reaches and lower reaches, a place which is not only has Kedusha, but which becomes the essence of Kedusha, a place which can be in which can be concentrated the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Alter von Slabodka points out that even angels can't do that. We say in the Kedusha, the angels say, Where is the place where the Ribbono Shel Olam is? Where is he concentrated? Where is his starting point? They can't find it, and all they can say is Baruch. How do we say? They can say the whole world is full of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and Baruch Hashem, Baruch. Wherever his place is, the angels can't even specify where it is. In general, wherever he is, we can bless him wherever he is, but if we know, we don't know where he is. So the Malachim are unable to pinpoint a position where the Ribbono Shel Olam exists in a concentrated form. And Yisrael, not only are they able to pinpoint such a position, but they're able to create such a position and say, this is where we're putting the Ribbono Shel Olam here. We're creating a point where the Ribbono Shel Olam Shechino can exist. And who can do that, says the Ribbono Shel Olam? Echad mi Yisrael. Any single Jew has the power to create a Mishkan. That's the power of the Jew. That's the power of an Ish Yisrael, of a Jewish person. Where does that power come from? May Eis Kol Ish Asher Yidvenu Liboy. There's only one condition that the Jew needs. Of course, there's got to be Kedusha. Of course, there's got to be Shmiras Halach. He's got to be an Ish, not just an ordinary person. He's got to be an Ish. He's got to be somebody who's Choshev, a Talmid Chacham, sure. But in addition to that, there's a criterion of Ish Asher Yidvenu Liboy. There must be a person who has been difficult to translate yet venerably, but who has been moved by his heart, who is motivated, who is internally generous, as Dr. Dinner said this morning, that it's not an external compulsion, but it comes from inside the individual. Isha shi yet venerably, what does all that mean? The Chochmas HaTuiro and the Chochmas HaOmim are two completely different concepts. The wisdom of the Torah and secular wisdom have nothing in common whatsoever. Chochma Bagoyim Tamin. If you are told that the Goyim possess wisdom, you must believe it. It's quite possible. The Goyim can master wisdom, they can be extremely clever, and they can have access to an enormous quantity of knowledge, and to deep knowledge. But it's Chochma. Torah Bagoyim Al Tamin. But if you're told that the Goyim understand Torah, that cannot be. That's not possible. There is something unique about Torah and the Jewish people that only they can click together. And the Goy is unable to understand Torah, and Torah cannot be absorbed by a Goy. What is it that is so unique about Chochmas HaTorah? There are many things, but we're going to dwell on one very important aspect of it, which is going to lend us an understanding of the power of the individual Jew. What is it that an Ish Yisrael, a Jew who's involved in Torah, a Jew who's a Talmid Chacham, what is it that he's got that gives him such enormous power that he can create a Mishkan all on his own? The Tanakh says in Iyuv, Perek Yud Beis, Iyuv comments in passing that Imoi Oiz V'Tushio, that the Ribbono Shel Olam possesses Oiz V'Tushio, strength and weakness, which the Metzudos learn means the Ribbono Shel Olam possesses this, the source of strength and weakness. It is he who decides who is strong and who is weak, when they're strong, when they're weak. The Ribbono Shel Olam controls power and he controls weakness. But Chazal, the Medrash, and the Yalkut learns it differently. Yalkut says, Oiz, what does Oiz mean? Power. Yalkut brings the posuk of Hashem, Oiz, li'amo yiten, that Hashem gave Oiz to his people. And Oiz, says the Medrash, is Torah. That's what it means. So when Eiv says, Imoi, Oiz, v'toshio, what he's talking about is not power, physical power, it's talking about the power of Torah, which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave only to the Jewish people. That's Torah. And why is Torah so powerful? Well, we see some of it here, we see to what extent it can go. But through Torah, a Yid can build a Mishkan. What is there more powerful than that? That one can take material things, one can take wood and copper and gold and cloth, and one can construct it in such a way and give it such kedusha that that becomes part of the Ribbono Shel Olam's world, that one elevates it to the highest levels of sanctity. That's what a Jew can do with Torah. Is that not Oiz? Is that not power? But the Medrash goes on to ask, why then is it called Toshia also? Why does Eiv say, Imoi Oiz v'Toshia? What does it mean, strength and weakness? The Torah is strength. Good, that we understand. But what does Toshia mean? Toshia means weakness. If the Torah is strength, it doesn't mean weakness. Answers the Medrash, it does. That there is a way of combining those two terms, strength and weakness, in one's understanding of what the Torah is. Because while the Torah gives power, and the Torah is power, at the same time, mateshes gufo shel adam, it weakens the body of a human being. It makes one physically weak. That is the power of Torah too. And we discussed this morning in the latest shiur what that chazal means. Power without physical weakness doesn't help very much. Rabbi Chonon Wasserman asks four questions. In the Kibbutz Ma'amorim, he asks four questions on emunah, on belief. Four very basic questions. They're so basic, they're almost childish in their simplicity. And yet they hit at the very foundation of virtually everything the Torah stands for. His first question is, why so often is the mind referred to in the Torah as lev. In Mishlei we have it all the time. Lev, and it means the mind. It doesn't mean the heart. It means the intellect. In the Shema we say, V'loy sasuru acharei levavchem. Acharei enechem, acharei levavchem. What does it mean, say Chazal? Apikrusis. You shouldn't have false beliefs. Says Rabbi Chonon, that should also be acharei roshchem. Should be after your heart, you after your mind. Your mind shouldn't lead you astray. What does it mean, your heart leading you astray? If it meant your feelings or your yetzer, good, okay. But if you're going to translate it as minus, if you're going to say that that means that you must not be misled into false beliefs, surely the seat of belief is the mind, not the heart? That's his first question. His second question is, if a person doesn't believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, a kofer, denies the existence of the Ribbono Shel Olam, why is he punished so severely? Why is it such a serious thing? He doesn't believe. It's an onus. What can he do? He lives in the world, and he was never taught, and he doesn't know, and therefore he doesn't believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Where should he believe? If the Ribbono Shel Olam was clearly present and one saw him every day, then you could claim that if you don't believe, that's a serious thing. But many people don't believe. They haven't merited an experience or an understanding. So he's an onus that's beyond his control. He should be free. It's not as if he's done something wrong. What has he done wrong? He just doesn't believe. It's not his fault. How can you instruct the person, thou shalt believe? And that part of his second kash is exactly that. How can we define emunah as one of the mitzvahs? Emunah is a fact. It's a feeling. You've either got it or you don't have it. But how can you instruct somebody, thou shalt believe? If he says, I can't, I don't. How do you go about it? What kind of mitzvah is this that has no definition? That's his second question. His third question is, how can a child of 13 years old and a girl of 12 years old be expected to have emunah? There were some very clever adults who didn't get to emunah. They're philosophers, they're all sorts of people with enormous intellects who don't believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Yet we expect every 13-year-old to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam to have emunah? And if he doesn't, it's punishable. It's a very serious avera. What kind of mitzvah is this that we impose? It's hard enough to impose it on any human being, but to impose it on children? Where do they have the intellect to understand emunah from? And his fourth question is that emunah is one of the mitzvahs, the sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. It's one of the seven Noahide laws and is therefore compelling also to non-Jews. And not only to sophisticated non-Jews who've studied in university and have had the opportunity of learning. That's not the only goyim. Sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach applies to every single guy. Says Rabbi Chonon, imagine the lowest of the low of goyim. Imagine an African cannibal from the middle of the jungle somewhere, who's never been out of the jungle. He's never seen civilization. He's never seen a school. He can't read. He hasn't been taught a language. He's lived among the animals all his life. Absolutely, imagine that the most distant human being from civilization is a goy. It's chayav the sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. Imagine a goy really at the bottom of the non-Jewish barrel. Imagine Eugene Terablanche. Imagine the absolute bottom that there can be. He also is chayav emunah. He's got to have emunah. On what basis such a chiyuv? Where is he supposed to get it from? What have his opportunities been? Asks Rabbi Chonon. Those are his four kashas. And his answer is frighteningly simple. So we see from there that emunah is natural. That you don't need an effort to believe. If you needed an effort to believe, it would be an unfair mitzvah to anybody, certainly to a child and to a non-Jew. You don't need it. It's absolutely natural to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he brings the Chovos Halvavos, as I mentioned in the Ladies' Week Shiur last week, he brings the Chovos Halvavos, who says that not to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam is as absurd as it would be if you studied Shakespeare's works, and afterwards you said to the person who gave them to you after you'd studied them, read it over and over again, and you'd been amazed at the complexity, at the beauty, at the structure, at the depth, at the insight. And you say to this person, who wrote this book? This is absolutely brilliant. Who was Shakespeare? And the person says, Shakespeare, there wasn't anybody called Shakespeare. That's just an imaginary name we give to the said author. What really happened was that one day there was a pot of ink and a large, big pot of ink and a large piece of paper. Somebody knocked over the pot of ink. his name happened to be Shakespeare or whatever, it doesn't matter who it was. And the ink just happened to land up in this form. And people started noticing there were letters, and they read it, and it happened to make sense. Purely coincidental. What, there's no author? That, of course, would be absurd. Says Rabbi Chanan, to look at a complex watch movement and ask the watchmaker, where does this come from? Who made this watch? And this is quite by chance. One gear wheel was formed because there was an earthquake and there was a piece of metal which got flattened, and there were all sorts of things that made it, made cracks in it like a gear wheel. And there was another one that happened to be lying right next to it, and then there was a pole that the earthquake pushed into that one, and that one pushed into that, and then after a period of time it all got contracted, and then there was ice which became stone, and that formed the surface, and there were various leaves lying on the surface, so the shadow that was when the sun shone down, that made the figures on the clock, and it just happens to be 1, 2, 3, 4 in that particular order, all purely coincidental. It's ridiculous, it's absurd. Says Rabbi Chanan, when something happens by coincidence, you don't see chokhmah. You don't see wisdom in it. If you see wisdom, you know there must have been a wise person behind it, constructing it. You cannot have wisdom by coincidence. You can have beauty by coincidence. You can have drama by coincidence, but you cannot have wisdom by coincidence. And what is there more wise than the Bria? A Bria which has created people capable of writing a Shakespeare, capable of making watches, capable of making computers. A whole Bria which works with such intricate precision that it makes all the things that we do look amateurish. Compared, go and look at the galaxies, go and look at astronomy, at space, at outer space, and see the workings within workings. It makes our little efforts here look amateurish. And yet, when we look at one of our computers, then clearly somebody made it. Couldn't have been a coincidence. But the same Chachomim who make those computers and design and conceive of these unbelievable concepts, those same wise people will look at outer space, which makes their work look amateurish, and of outer space they'll say, but coincidence, Big Bang, just happened. It's absolutely absurd, says Rabbi Chanan. If one looks at the Bria not to perceive that there's wisdom behind it, that's abnormal, it's unnatural. And that's why the human being can be instructed that there's a mitzvah to be maimin and even a child, because it's absolutely natural. Just as no child of 13 will look at a watch and buy the story that it came to exist coincidentally, so no child of 13 or no goy from Central Africa is going to look at the Bria and say, this was by coincidence. Why then, asks Rabbi Chanan, do great philosophers make the mistake? A young child, natural. A cannibal from Central Africa, natural. So why have there been great philosophers? Aristotle, who the Rambam regards as having been a person of such magnificent intellect. And he wasn't a maimon? He couldn't see that there was wisdom behind the creation of the world? What's gone wrong? If it's so natural to believe in it all, what has happened to make people miss the point? Answers Rabbi Chanan, V'ashichad yaver enei chachomim. The power of bribery is to corrupt wise people too. How much bribery, says Rabbi Chanan? Even a penny. The tiniest bit of bribery already distorts the vision. How great a chochem do you have to be, or how small a chochem is affected by this bribery? The Torah doesn't limit it. Chachomim. Even Chachomim, which the Torah regards as Chachomim, at the time of Matan Torah, that means a Moshe, an Aaron, it makes no difference how wise you are, says Rabbi Chanan. There is a principle that bribery distorts. The desire, human desire, distorts human understanding. Great desire distorts understanding a great deal. Small desire distorts understanding a little bit. Great intellects are distorted less easily. Small intellects are distorted more easily. But distortion there is and there must be. And bribery does not mean only from an external source, anybody who has a desire. If he has not controlled himself and cultivated his character to be able to ignore his desires totally in his perceptions, in his understandings, in his thoughts, in his words and in his deeds, and to work only around that which is emes, if the person has not cultivated that within his character, then his desires still play a part in his visions. And if the desire plays a part in the vision, there is distortion. And no human being with natural desires wants to acknowledge an oil of Yerushalayim, the yoke of God-fearing. That's not something pleasant for somebody who has desires. So the yoke of God-fearing is either taught to a person, and if one hasn't had the opportunity to learn it, one should see it from the Bria. It should be a natural feeling, as Avraham developed it. But since there are desires within the human being which have not been put in place, says Rabbi Chonon, it is not possible to see the world as it really is. And we're prepared to believe the most amazing of stories, rather than to acknowledge that there was a Borei Olam, that there was a creator of the world who demands certain standards from us. That's Chochmas HaTorah, which is Oiz. On the one hand, there's enormous intellect. But enormity of intellect does not guarantee perception of the truth, unless there is a simultaneous Mateshes Gufo Shelodom. There must be a weakening of the material side of man. Man's desires must be weakened. His ambitions must be weakened and his ego must be shattered before he can utilize the Oiz of Torah to perceive the truth as it really is. It doesn't matter having all the wisdom. Aristotle had more wisdom than most Yidden have. And yet he couldn't see the truth. Why? Because he lacked wisdom? No. Because he lacked the eyes to see? No. Because he had a big Yetzirah as well. And the big Yetzirah, the big ego, the ambitions, the desires, that distorts the vision. We're not going to allow ourselves to see things as they really are, for as long as we have powers of ambition, powers of self-grandeur, and powers of desire, which are motivating us too. That's Hashem Oiz La'amo Yitein. Hashem gives his people Oiz. But what is that Oiz? It's not just the power of intellect. It's the totality of power, which comes from the combination of increased intellect and decreased physical presence. That doesn't mean that a Talmid Chacham gets sick and weak. The power of his intellect is able more to compensate for the weakening of the physical side of him. But that weakening of the physical side is an important part of his progress in Torah. That's why we regard Zakenim, the older the people, the older the Talmid Chacham, the greater he inevitably is, not just because he's had more time to learn, but equally important because as he's gotten older, his youthful desires are more easily placed in control. And when a person is Yidvenu Libre, what does that mean, Yidvenu Libre? A person is willing from his heart to donate, to give. Then, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, all limitations are removed from the individual. He is no longer governed by things physical. That's what's important about Nedovas HaLev. That once there is a decision to give, then all sorts of things become possible. The Tiferes Tzion explains on this Medrash that what the Medrash is saying is explaining why the word the Yikhu is used. And they shall, the Yikhu li Trumo, tell B'nai Yisrael, and they shall take for me a donation. We discussed last night, Rashi and Spoon and others. The Medrash is giving a new interpretation. The Yikhu li Trumo means, and they will acquire a donation for me. From where will they get it, Moshe Rabbeinu? What you're asking of them is more than they have. They don't have the resources, whether we're looking at it from a spiritual and emotional point of view, that they don't have the energies and the spiritual resources, or whether we're looking at it materially, you want gold and silver and copper and precious stones, where's it going to come from? Cedar trees, all sorts of unbelievable things you're going to need. Where's it going to come from, Moshe? Answers the Ribbono Shel Olam, v'yikhuli, they'll buy it, they'll get it, they'll acquire it. Where from? They're in the desert, where are they going to get this from? If there is nidvas lev, the material will be supplied. Nidvas lev is a way of looking at things. A person comes to collect money from you. What is the tendency to do? To try and understand the needs of the institution, to figure out how much I can afford to give, and to reach some kind of decision as to how much I can give. But clearly one of the first things we look at is how much I have available. What are my earnings at the moment? Take my 10%, how many other calls have I had on tzedakah? One works it out, and one gives. That's the normal way to give. But that's not Yidvenu Libre. Yidvenu Libre is that one's decision to give is not based on what one's got. It's based only on what the need is. says the Ribbono Shel Olam, once it's Isha Sheyidvenu Liboy, once the heart is decided to give, the Ribbono Shel Olam will provide that which is needed to give. And that's a whole new yesod, that's a whole new principle in human living. If we're constantly going to cut the suit according to the cloth, they say. If we're going to live like that, then sure we can't have a suit bigger than the cloth. But if we decide to cut the suit not according to the cloth, we'll cut the suit according to what the Ribbono Shel Olam demands. That's what we'll cut. Where is the cloth going to come from? The yikhu that will be provided. That's a completely different way of looking at it. And that applies in all areas. It applies in material areas. It's quite amazing that very often you find people, I say very often, I'm almost prepared to say always, you find one type of person who cuts the suit to fit the cloth. Careful budgeting, counts the pennies, never overspends, careful with everything, never manages, never comes out. Just can't come out. Mashiach comes to make it stocky, he starts making a calculation, good, he's got 18 rand, 20 rand he can manage, 50, whatever it is, calculates. You've got other kinds of people who somehow never seem to be calculating. If there's a need, they spend, it has to be done, good, fine, need some sforim, he buys the sforim, Mashiach comes, he gives the Mashiach, there's an opportunity, there's a Sudis mitzvah, it costs something, he pays for it, it's always there. And he's very often earning much less than the other crowd, and sometimes has bigger expenses than the other. And somehow he always manages. Up overdraft, down overdraft, but life goes on and he manages. He survives it all. What is it? What's happening? There is such an attitude that the Ribbono Shel Olam decides on the way you're looking. The way to look at it is there a need? That's it. And one has to try as hard as one can to be, make sure that it's v'yikhu li terumah, that one's spending on the Ribbono Shel Olam. Please don't try this on your own spending. It doesn't work. But when you're looking at the Ribbono Shel Olam spending, when you're spending for the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's an attitude of v'yikhu. You'll acquire, once there's been a yidven liboy, once there's a decision, I've got to do it. That's it. How much it costs, basically. Where I'm going to get it from, I don't know. But it has to be done. One finds in Eretz Yisrael people marrying off their children, buying them apartments, poor people. What it is, we don't live on that kind of standard. The amount of money that is spent by families in Eretz Yisrael on marrying off their children is the type of money that we in this land of gold and honey here don't have. And the poor people, Kohelites, Bnei Torah, somehow manage. They raise big families and they marry them all off and they survive. I'm not talking about the here and there, one finds terrible casualties, never, of people who can't manage. People have to go out collecting. One has such things too. But by and large, it doesn't work that way. By and large, they manage. There is no economic explanation for it at all. Here, when isn't, and I laugh sometimes when people come and they discuss the size of their families and can they manage to have more children? What's the problem? What's the problem? Look, can one manage? Money, are you worried about? Yeah, money is also one thing. Got to educate them all. It's not that we won't eat, but children have to be educated, and they have to be clothed, and one likes to put a bit of pride into it. Not easy. So what are you worried about? Resources. You look around and you say, my goodness, this is a family with two or three motor cars, a nice big house, swimming pool, two or three maids, both husband and wife gainfully employed, doing quite well. And they're worried about, will they manage another child? You find in Eretz Yisrael, another child, big, huge, happy family, 6 children, 7 children, 8 children, 9 children, and they all get married off, and they're all living happily ever after. How is it possible? What is it? And it's all very well saying, yeah, but they have to live in little families and little flats over there, but a little flat over there costs much more than a mansion over here. So you've got to see it, you've got to perceive it right. When you look at a family in Eretz Yisrael, a poor family, with 9 children, and the parents manage to marry all 9 off, and each has a little apartment. That's not a little apartment, that's a house in Houghton. You would realize what the value of that little apartment is. This is expensive. And they manage. What's the difference? Where do they get it from? It's a decision. Torah is important to me. My life is Torah. Family. the Ribbono, it will be all right. The Yikhuli Truma, it has to be done, and the Ribbono Shalom provides. There is such a thing, even on material levels. Of course, we're not on that madrega. Of course, we have to be worried about where it's going to come from. Because there hasn't yet been an Asher Yidvenu Libo. There hasn't yet been the commitment. Once there's a commitment of no matter what it costs, I have to do it. Chas v'shalom, the other way around, if one thinks of a person who's just coming out, battling a bit of an overdraft also, interest rates have gone up, now it's even harder to come out, and chas v'shalom, terrible illness, and he needs heart surgery, and it's going to cost 100,000 rand. That's what he needs. Is there a moment's question in his or his family's mind of how will I manage? Should I or shouldn't I? Is that an issue at all? It's not an issue. It has to be done. There's just no question. Where am I going to get 100,000 rand from? I haven't a clue. Don't know. I have to borrow, beg, ask, get help, tzedakah. I don't know. But to do it, it has to be done. There's no question about that. That's Yidvenu Libo. It has to be. Once there's a decision that something has to be done because it's right and it's L'shem Shemayim and that's why I'm doing it, then there's the Yikhuli Truma, says the Medrash. Moshe Rabbeinu, don't limit the capacity of the Jewish people. You're questioning how 600,000 people can build a Mishkan. I have news for you, Moshe Rabbeinu. Provided there's Yidvenu Libo, one Yid can build a Mishkan. That's the power of the Jew. That's the power of an Ish Yisrael. The Yikhuli Truma, where are they going to get it from? They will acquire it. After there's been a Yidvenu Libo, not before. If you decide what to give on the basis of what you possess, then of course you will never have any more. But if you decide what to give on the basis of what is needed, then the Yikhuli Truma, you'll get it from somewhere or other. And that applies not only in money, that applies in energy, that applies in kichus, it applies in resources. Sometimes a person is tired, okay, can't come to the davening in the morning, can hardly make the shiurim, and you say to him, so tired. Okay, he's working, how many hours a night are you sleeping? 6 hours a night. Difficult to manage, but what can he do? And then there's a crisis of some sort, and all of a sudden he's alert, and he's sharp, and he's sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night, and he's managing fine. When there's a need, the Ribbono Shel Olam provides. Once one recognizes the need. If you're going to be blind to the need because you don't think you have the resources, that's when there's shaykhat. When we look and we judge needs on the basis of resources, then we fail to see the needs and we fail to recognize the resources. If one looks and says, can I have a bigger family, and one analyzes it in terms of my resources, then of course the answer is no. Who can manage more than one child? Two parents, maybe two children, one for him, one for her. That's it. But how can you have three children? Who look after the third one? It's not possible to imagine being capable of doing it. One's got three, or four or five. It's very difficult to understand. If one's examining one's resources, one says, I'm limited. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu said. Bnei Israel are limited. How can you ask people who are limited to build something which is unlimited, which is infinite? Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's the mistake, Moshe Rabbeinu. They are not limited. The Jewish person has no limits. Provided there's Asher Yidvenu Libo. When a person undertakes something, the Ribbono Shel Olam provides the koichos. And it's not your business to worry where it comes from. First, identify the need. Once the need has been identified, the Ribbono Shel Olam will provide everything else. But don't allow your resources to color your perception of the need. That must not be allowed. That's the first part of the Midrash. The Medrash in Eiv also continues. The Medrash in Eiv, remember the first part is that Torah, Oiz means Torah. Why is it called Toshia, says the Medrash? Because Mateshes Gufo Yishol Odom. Because Torah weakens the body of the human being. One sees it so much. You see very often. One sees it. In every sphere of life, once you understand this principle, it almost becomes humorous to watch people. Because people become so transparent. You have the kind of person, I've mentioned it in the shiur so many times, you have the kind of person who always makes it to the shiur. You have the kind of person who only sometimes makes it to the shiur, but he's a person who sincerely wants to learn. So when he's not there, you can know for sure there's a very good reason. It's not stunned that he's not around. There's a very good reason. Oynes. But the funny thing happens. Oynes strikes the same people over and over again, whereas it somehow eludes others. Some people never seem to be struck by oynes. they're always there. Also got businesses, also got professions, also got families, also got responsibilities, but somehow they're there. And other people, there's always an oiness. And when you ask them, why weren't you at the shir? The reason they give you, you've got to be murdered. There's no way you could have been at the shir. Taka oiness. But it's just very amazing that there's this constant situation of oiness. And one has to stop and ask oneself, why is the Rebbeinu Shlom placing oiness at my feet? Every second day, oiness, oiness, oiness. What's the oiness? If one's working within limitations, then one is limited. If one says, I will be at the shir if I can, then one will not be able to, because one can't. It's unnatural. But if one says, I am learning no matter what, that's my Mesiras Nefesh. And if that means I'm going to have a more difficult time, if that means I'm going to have to tighten my belt, if that means that I'm not going to be able to accept the jobs or pursue the ambitions that I had otherwise, no, so be it. If that's the way it is, then somehow the Ribbono Shel Olam removes it altogether. Removes all the oinsim. The human being becomes limitless. The human being becomes infinite in his resources, because he has identified a need which has superseded an analysis of his resources. His need is something which, the need is something which is so much more important, and it's li, it's for the Ribbono Shel Olam, ve'yikhu li terumo. You have dedicated time and energy to Torah, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I will provide the resources. Don't you worry, you'll acquire the resources that you need for it, once that dedication has been made. You find other people always get sick. Funny thing, they get sick, but they're genuinely sick. You say, where were you? Flu. Yeah, flu, temperature of 104 degrees. You can't argue with that. You can't say, no, you should have, you can only say, sorry, for a shlema. 2 weeks later, not there again. What happened? Got run over. Unbelievable. Take it, for a shlema. It's not so bad. He only broke a leg, whatever it is, but it'll be all right. It's okay. 6 weeks later, he's got a splitting migraine. He's had it for 3 weeks, though. He doesn't know what to do about it. What can you do? Wish him a for a shlema. But then you start asking yourself, what is with this guy? Why is he always sick? So you get worried, you check with his doctor, you say, what? The doctor says there's no connection. The flu was flu, the running over was the running over, the migraines, the one has nothing to do with the other. Say to the doctor, are you sure? Absolutely sure. Maybe the flu caused the sinuses to block, and that caused the migraine, which gave him a headache, and he blacked out when he crossed the road and didn't see the car. It's really all wonders, isn't it? The doctor says, nothing to do. The flu was over, absolutely. Sinuses were clear when he got knocked over, and the headache came much later. The one has nothing to do with the other. For doctors, that's fine. They don't have any further kashas. Flu was treated. Broken leg cured. The migraines are cured. The doctor gets his due and his yeshukach, and that's the end of the story. But a rov worries. A rov says to me, they all seem to be connected. Why didn't the Ribbono Shel Olam share it out? One person could have had the flu, and another person could have had the migraine, and another person could have been knocked over. Why one person all the time? And you analyze, there's no reason for it. There is such a thing as a person who says, when I feel good enough, I learn. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, when you feel good enough, you learn. You think it's normal to feel good? It's a fine. People think it's normal. Didn't Churchill have something to say about that? That most of the work, I think he said, most of the work in the world is done by people who most of the time aren't feeling very well. People think that the normal person thinks you're supposed to, normally you feel well. Normally you feel fine, and if you don't feel well, that's a reason to slack off. There's another kind of person who understands that that isn't so. There's a body that's working, and there's always something which isn't right. It's very unusual to feel well. The only thing is, when you're creatively involved and you're dynamic and you're doing things, you don't feel the things. But if you would sit at home and concentrate on your body, it wouldn't take long before you felt heart palpitations and a slight headache and a tingling pain in your teeth somewhere and sinuses beginning to block up. It's not very difficult to become a hypochondriac. Not very difficult at all. All you need to do is to cease to be creatively involved in real things outside you. And you'll start feeling the illness. You'll start feeling good and sick. Because it's normal to be ill. It's normal not to feel quite right. The difference is, some people cut their suits to suit the cloth, to fit the cloth, and some people say, forget the cloth, there's a job to be done. Feel well, don't feel well, that's it. If I can do it, it'll be done, that's it. And if I can't do it, it'll also be done. That's Mesiras Nefesh. And once a Jew identifies with Mesiras Nefesh, Isha Sheh Yidvenu Liboy, a man says, I want to do it, I will do it, no matter what, it will be done. Ribbono Shel Olam says, from this person, all the obstacles must be removed. He becomes limitless in his capacity and limitless in his capability. And so one finds that all these unfortunate events which seem to plague the same people over and over again, okay, it's because they allow it to happen. They're cutting their clothes to suit the cloth. But the Midrash says, not only is it Matesh's Gufoy Shalodah, not only does Torah weaken the body of the person, but Torah also is Matesh's Einov Shalodah. It also weakens the eyes. Why does the Midrash pick out the eyes? It's already said Gufoy, the eyes not also part of the Guf. Why does the Midrash emphasize the eyes too are weakened? So the ophthalmologists will tell us the reason is because when you learn Torah, the light is usually not that fantastic, and you shock it a lot when you read backwards and forwards, and the eye doesn't like that kind of thing, and it's small print that you're always looking at. Matesh's Einov Shalodah. But the role of the Medrash is not to give ophthalmological advice or to make ophthalmological comment. That's not the purpose of the Medrash. There must be something ruchnis, there must be something spiritual, and there must be a value in that statement. And here one needs to understand. There is indeed a connection between perception and vision. But the connection is inverse. The better the vision, the worse the perception. That's what the Medrash teaches us. And Torah is Mateshes Einov Shalodah. It weakens the vision in order to increase the perception. Why should that be? The eye, the vision of the eye relates only to the surface. The eye cannot see beneath the surface unless the object is transparent. If the object is totally transparent, the eye can't see it at all. So really the eye is limited and restricted. The eye can only see the surface. And therefore the better the vision, the more accurately do you see the surface. But the surface distracts you from perceiving what lies under the surface. And I gave the example this morning of Leonardo da Vinci, who used to paint only on dull days, on overcast days, because when the sun was too bright, he felt he couldn't perceive the colors correctly. He could see them correctly, but you can't perceive them. There's too much superficiality. And superficiality is an enemy of depth. The more vivid is the superficial appearance, the more obscure is the understanding of the depth. The more dramatic the visual impact, the poorer is the understanding of what lies beneath it all. That's why the media has such a field day today. They show dramatic visual impacts on the television screens, which blinds the human being totally to thinking beneath the surface. That dramatic impact is so overpowering that it closes the mind to analysis and to understanding. But if you write an article, as we've often discussed in the newspaper, without pictures, there the vision is not so vivid. One has to actually sort through, one has to read and reason. And there, in the absence of this vivid and dramatic portrayal of the event, one can allow oneself to penetrate the depths of what really is happening, of what's really occurred. One cannot glean an understanding of world events from watching news on the television. One can be given the understanding by a good newscaster. He might tell you what he wants you to understand about it. But if you want an original understanding, if you want your own understanding, you cannot glean it from the television. One has to read a good newspaper. One has to read an article that analyzes it, that goes through it step by step, and gives you the opportunity to think it through and to come out with your own chidushim, to come out with your own perception. The more there is visual impact imposed upon the human mind, the less the human being has the capacity and the ability to analyze and to perceive beneath the surface. The eyes of Torah, built into it is the capacity to weaken the body and to weaken the eye, which means no passions, the passions are weakened, the ego, the ambitions are weakened, which allows the intellect to free itself of the constraints of desires, and the eye is able to free itself from the constraints of superficiality, and it is able to visualize with depth and to have and possess perception rather than pure vision. That's what the Medrash means, the Toshio, Torah is Mateshes Kechei Shalodah. And our Midrash goes on and says, Af b'mon shehoyo yoyred li Yisrael, also with a mon that came down for Yisrael, hoyo yoydos boyavonim toivos umargolius. Precious stones and pearls came down with a mon. What would you imagine people did? Imagine today. Mon comes down, or imagine with the rain, precious stones and pearls come down. What would you imagine people would do? They'll run and fill their buckets as much as they can with the precious stones. What does it say? V'hoyu ha-gedoylim shubohim boyin ha-malaktin riso. Only the gedoylim came. The Chofetz Chaim came and collected the precious stone. The Gaon Gadol came. And Rabbi Kiv Heger came. And Rabbi Yehuda came. They came. The gvirim, the businessmen, the investors, the ordinary people, the balabatim, they were nowhere near. They didn't come. How come? What a strange medrash. Tiferet Tzion says because they didn't see the stones. They didn't perceive it. Back to this perception that they didn't see. But that's not what the medrash says. The medrash says they didn't. It says the gedolim. It doesn't say v'hayu ha-gedolim shebohim ro'in u'malaktin. It doesn't say the gedolim saw and came to collect. It just says ha-gedolim shebohim bo'in u'malaktin. The great ones, the gedolim, they came and gathered. Which implies that those who were not gedolim didn't come, although they did see it. So why didn't they come? Why didn't they also come and fill their containers with these diamonds and rubies and sapphires and pearls and precious stones? Why didn't they do it too? The answer is that they saw. They saw with perfect vision the diamonds and the sapphires and the emeralds and the rubies. Who couldn't have seen that? But they didn't perceive. What does that mean? Take, for example, the stock exchange in October 1987. Remember? Collapsed. What did everybody do? They sold their shares as quickly as they could. What did the Gedolim do? They bought as quickly as they could. They bought and bought and bought. Don't forget, for every share that was sold, somebody bought. Who were the Gedolim? The buyers or the sellers? Who was selling? Who was buying? In every transaction there was a buyer and a seller. Everybody says, "Oh, everybody's selling." If the newspapers would simply have reversed it and said, "Oh, everybody's buying." It's the same thing. As many shares were bought as were sold. So the headline shouldn't have been stampede to sell shares. The headline should have been stampede to buy shares. And then the stock exchange wouldn't have collapsed, of course. It would have lasted for less than a day. Who were the Gedolim? The Sanlams and the First National Banks and the Liberty Lights. What were they doing? Selling? They were busy buying as quickly as the old ladies and the little investors were selling, so they were buying. Why? When there's too much of a thing, when there are a lot of sellers, it loses value. Only a wise person with perception has his understanding of value not influenced by what other people think. He has his own determination. And that's what distinguishes the master businessman from the amateur. If I value a particular stone at 1,000 rand, and I go to the seller, and he says he wants 1,000 rand for it, or he wants 1,200 rand for it, I'm not going to do a particularly good deal. So I might get him down to 1,100 rand. Maybe he'll give it to me at 1,000 rand. Still no mitzi. So I bought it at its true value. What have I gained? But if I view it as worth 2,000, and he doesn't, he views it as worth 1,000. One of us are making a mistake. Who's going to be right? The person with better perception is going to be right. So if I come along and say, my goodness, he's selling it for only 1,000. Yesterday, I saw it, the same thing, for 2,000. That means it's gone down. That means it's not worth very much. If that's the way I'm going to look at it, then I'm looking at it with vision, not with perception. If it was worth 2,000 yesterday, why should it be worth 1,000 today? If I was willing to pay for a share yesterday, 100 rand, why was I willing to pay for 100 rand for the share yesterday? Because I analyzed the company's figures and its potential and its management, and I believe it has growth potential. That means, in my opinion, it's worth 100. Because tomorrow, and in a year's time, and in 5 years' time, it's going to be worth 1,000. So I'm willing to invest 100. All of a sudden, there's a stampede on the stock exchange, and the share goes down to 10. Now, all of a sudden, I'm not willing to buy it anymore. Why? Yesterday, you were prepared to pay 100. Now, you're not willing to pay 10? Because you've been scared. Who have you been scared by? By its ready availability. There are lots of people selling it for 10. Tomorrow it will probably be worth 9. What should I touch it for? That's the way one sees if one's using vision. But if one's using perception, one says, my goodness, what a metziah. I value it at 100. The seller values it as 10. Let me take as many as I can. Precious stones started coming down with the moon. What effect did it have on the Hamoin Am? There's so much coming down, it's obviously valueless. It has no value. Why should I collect it today? It'll be there tomorrow too. The Gedolim said, no, these are precious stones, and a precious stone remains a precious stone. This is an opportunity that the Ribbono Shel Olam is giving us. And the Gedolim took the opportunity. And that's the difference between the man of perception and the man of vision. I'm using vision not in its metaphorical sense of vision, but just of sight, of eyesight. Eyesight doesn't see opportunities. Eyesight only sees something dramatic, something, if something is heavily advertised, it doesn't matter what it's worth, if it's heavily advertised and made to look attractive, he buys, the fool. The man with perception, he's able to see an opportunity. He sees right through the advertisement. They're glossy, they're superficial, they're distractive, he doesn't look at them. But here and there he notices an opportunity. And he says, this has been brought to me by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and I must take advantage of it. That's the man of perception. It's a different thing altogether. Only the Gedolim had that perception, because they weren't being distracted by vision. Why not? Because Torah mateshes einov shel adam. Because the Torah weakens the eye. And that's the biggest bracha, to have weak vision, weak superficial vision, enables you to see with your brain, not to see with your eye. And when one is seeing with one's brain, then one is perceiving, then one is noticing opportunities, then one sees Hashgacha, then one sees the Ribbono Shel Olam's guiding hand, then one sees the opportunity to do things which otherwise couldn't be done. That was something the Gedolim could do. And therefore says the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, you're looking at people and you think they're ordinary. And as an ordinary person you're asking, where are they going to get the koiches from? I'll tell you, Moshe Rabbeinu, the koiches are all around. There is enormous resource in the world. There is a limitless fund of opportunities. All you need to do is notice them. You need to see them. But to see them, you don't need vision. To see them, you need perception. And for that, you need tzidkus. For that, you need Torah. For that, you need musr. For that, you need chokhmah. For that, you need maturity. For that, you need humility. And kol ish mi Yisrael, every ish, every godel in Yisrael, every great person in Yisrael has that Torah, and has that musr, and has that anova, he has that modesty to be able to perceive. And when people open their eyes, and they're able to see what there is taki in the world, and they're able to see how limitless the resources are, and how limitless their energies are, then they're able to achieve things which are totally beyond them. And that really is an aim that one has to achieve, one of vital urgency in one's life, to view the opportunities not on the basis of the resources, but to view the opportunities for themselves, to view the needs not on the basis of the resources, but to view the needs in themselves, to view what there is in the world, to understand and to analyze not on the basis of what I am and who I am, but on the basis of what the objective thing is, how precious it is in reality. And on the basis of that, to decide what I can do about it. Then one finds the yikhuli truma, that we don't only give to the Ribbono Shel Olam the contributions of our money, and our energies, and our emotions, and our resources, and our bodies. We don't only give that which we have. But the yikhuli, the Ribbono Shel Olam, enables us to acquire everything that we need to fulfill our obligations of Nedovah's so made.